From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Mike Myers. He created the swingin' spy Austin Powers and his arch-villain Dr. Evil. On Saturday Night Live, he was the excellent co-host of Wayne's World. He insisted that his guest touch his monkey on Sprockets and got a little verklempt as Linda Richman on Coffee Talk. In Myers' new film, The Love Guru, he plays a character he's been developing for years, Guru Pitka, the second most famous guru in America. He's trying to surpass his competitor, Deepak Chopra. Also, why are more Americans, particularly children, developing allergies to foods like peanuts? We'll ask Dr. Hugh Sampson, president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mike Myers, has created some great characters over the years. When he was a cast member of Saturday Night Live from 1989 to 95, he became famous for his sketches like Wayne's World, Coffee Talk with Linda Richman, and Sprockets. In his three Austin Powers films, he played both the swingin' super spy and his arch-rival, Dr. Evil. Myers' new satirical film, The Love Guru, is built around a character he's been developing for years, Guru Pitka. Pitka has a posh ashram in L.A. where many celebrities come to seek enlightenment. The movie is in part a comic tribute to Deepak Chopra, who has become a good friend of Myers. In fact, Myers wrote the introduction to Chopra's new novel about a comic who bears some similarities to Myers. Here's a scene from The Love Guru. It's a flashback. The young Pitka, who is still known by his American name, Maurice, is in India, sitting at the feet of his guru, along with another young acolyte. The guru is played by Ben Kingsley.
Deepak, why do you want to join the Thagin Maipuda ashram?
To seek my true self.
Maurice, why do you want to join?
I want to become a guru so girls will like me. Then I will like myself.
Deepak, you will enjoy love in all forms. Maurice,
you must wear this chastity belt.
Chastity belt? That sucks.
Mike Myers, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a real pleasure to have you here. Let me start by asking you to describe the character of Guru Pitka.
Well, the character is, he's an American who was raised in an ashram in India. And he is taught a non-denominational, fictional belief system, kind of like the Force in Star Wars, called drama. And he's taught in the ways of drama by his guru, the guru Thagin Maipuda, who is played by Sir Ben Kingsley. And he's the number two guru in the United States, number two self-help spiritualist in the United States. Number one is Deepak Chopra, and he lives in his shadow.
Now, Guru Pitka has a self-help book for every problem in the world. What are some of the titles of his books?
I know you are, but what am I? Another book he has about self-talk is called Stop Hitting Yourself. Stop Hitting Yourself.
I like it.
There's one more. Why Are You Still Hitting Yourself? And he has a book on the grieving process called What's This? A Dead One of These.
And I like, if you're happy and you know it, think again.
Yes, that's correct, yes.
Did you read a lot of those books before writing the movie?
In 1991, my father passed away. Two things emerged creatively for me. One was Austin Powers. My parents are from Liverpool, England. My dad used to literally wake me up at night, even on a school night, to watch British comedies. So Austin Powers is a tribute to all the British comedies that my father made me watch, in essence. I'm glad he did. And the Guru Pitka is... started as a way of dealing with that loss of, it kind of rocked my world. I didn't understand why the universe would take away the one guy I wanted to see all of this amazing success that was happening, all of my dreams, more than my dreams, because I never thought it would go this well. He died in 91, and I just started reading. I started reading things philosophical, things spiritual. And this is something I've been working on for many, many years. I wanted to have a very silly delivery system for some ideas that I actually believe in, which is you've got to initially lighten up, go back to the old pain, and rewrite a new paradigm.
Before your father died, had you ever explored anything remotely religious or spiritual?
And I'll add on to that, I hadn't even looked at anything philosophical. It rocked my world, man. I was in a lot of pain. Nothing really bad had ever happened to me. My career was taking off and all those dreams were happening. And then there was this interesting contradiction that, on the weekends I'd go home and visit my father who was in a hospital with Alzheimer's. It was rough. And, in 1994 I did a show of five characters, one of which was Austin Powers. The other one was the Guru Pitka, both for the first time. And it just is the flip side of it. One was all the British comedy that my British father had exposed me to. And the other was all of the reading that I had been doing to kind of, I was in a what's it all about Elfie state. It wasn't depression. It was, I call it being life slapped.
Let me ask you, when your father died, he had already had Alzheimer's, and I think I read that you felt his personality had disappeared about a year before he actually died. How did that affect your grieving process for him, since he'd already stopped being the person that you remembered and stopped being the person that you could really communicate with in the way that you did before he got Alzheimer's?
Well, there's no conclusion. See, that's the hard part about Alzheimer's. That's the cruel part of it, is you start to see him be forgetful. You start to see him not be present. And this is a funny guy. You know how, like, you know how the Beatles were funny in A Hard Day's Night and Help and interviews?
Yeah.
You know, the turn left at Greenland. You know, there's always a joke. Nobody can get too full of themselves in a Liverpool house. You either, you know, get cut down verbally, or in some cases you get a cuff to the back of the head. But, you know, very working class background. And in Liverpool, it's an interesting place because it's always been economically depressed. So the only thing that people own are their own bodies. It's the most sexual place I've ever been to. Sensual, passionate. One of the most violent places, one of the most loving, and everybody can play guitar and tell a joke. It is the pool of life, Liverpool.
But getting back to your father and grieving after...
Well, he was one of those guys. Mm-hmm. And so the ultimate irony of having somebody who is full of life from the pool of life is watching the life force leave his body, and there's nothing you can do about it. And so there was a time when I realized that his personality had left his body. It was sad, but there was no body to grieve over. And so it was a very, very protracted and hellacious experience. And it sets a feller thinking, you know. I'm Father's Day was just this Sunday. I mean, it's still a little rough. Christmases are rough. But pain plus time, you know. Time wounds all heals, as they say.
Can I just stop you right here? Because I think a lot of our listeners are thinking, wait a minute, this is Mike Myers. He's really funny. And what he's talking about is pain. What he's talking about
is
his quest for spirituality. You know. And I think people are going to be really surprised by how serious you're sounding and how in pain you still appear to be.
I'm highly functional. I do think that my father's up in heaven watching all of this. I do believe that we'll all hang out later, that temporarily I'm not able to see him. But honestly, you know, comedy is pain plus time, as Lenny Bruce said. And there is just a, you know, I don't know quite how to put it. I think, you know, my father's philosophy was there's nothing so painful that can't be laughed at eventually. And the state of grace is having that detachment to find even the darkest situations. And I think that's what comedy does for us. You know, Lorne Michaels used to say, you know, no matter how freaked out he was, he used to put on Johnny Carson and all was right in the world. Because Johnny would talk about whatever's going on in the world, and I don't know, it gives dignity to the proceedings. That's how I like to see it. But, you know, the movie's very silly. I mean, silly is the delivery system of this movie, you know?
So you were raised in part on British comedies. You say your father used to wake you up in the middle of the night to show them to you.
He would be like, ooh, there's something really funny. And I'd be like half asleep in my Jimmy Jams. And I knew I had like a math test in the morning. He'd go, well, you can study the math test in the morning. This is really funny. It's Peter Sellers and I'm All Right, Jack, and you'll love it. And I would wake up and he'd make me a cup of tea to wake me up. He'd like, ooh, let's make some tea and watch Peter Sellers. And it's one of my happiest memories. It was an amazing bond, you know, with my father, you know.
What about James Bond films? Like, how were you first exposed to them?
Well, of course, he was British. And so my dad, you know, British people are, there's nobody more English than an Englishman who no longer lives in England. And so he lived in Canada. And His house looked like a house in Liverpool. It was like Canadian on the outside and you know, filled with, you know, brass horses and figurines and you know, pictures of Liverpool and stuff. James Bond was British. My dad loved Sean Connery. He loved Michael Caine. Michael Caine because he had a working class accent. Most actors were like, hello, I say, how are you? I'm from England. And my dad had a Liverpool accent, like, you know, great, love it, wonderful. He would say the word squirrel, squiddle. And I'd go, hold on, there's not that many L's in that word. Squiddle, kookbook, squiddle. And, you know, Michael Caine was one of the first people with a working class regional accent to be in the movies. Sean Connery was just British cool. Just, he's British. We're so happy he's, you know what I mean? And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that you're endowed with, you know?
So let me play a scene from Austin Powers. And this is from the first Austin Powers film. And Austin Powers is on the trail of Dr. Evil. And he's with a fellow spy, a beautiful spy, of course, played by Elizabeth Hurley. Mm-hmm. And they're pretending to be husband and wife so that they could check into the hotel together. And here they are having just checked into their room.
So, which side of the bed do you want?
You're sleeping on the sofa, Mr. Powers. In fact, I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that the only reason we're sharing a room is to keep up the context that we're a married couple on vacation.
Right. Shall we shag now or shall we shag later? How do you like to do it? Do you like to wash up first? You know, top and tails, whore's bath. Personally, before I'm on the job, I like to give my undercarriage a bit of a how's your father.
That's so funny. Mike Myers and Elizabeth Hurley in the first Austin Powers film. And I should say, in that scene, you're wearing an orange jacket, multicolored striped pants, and a blue polka dot shirt.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So how did you come up with words like, you know, deciding we were going to use shag a lot and shagadelic?
I, you know, me and my brothers are the only people in my gene pool who are not from Liverpool. I have a couple of cousins who are just north of London, but they were all from Liverpool. And they would say things like shag and randy and, you know, the genesis. I mean, everything evolves. Everything evolves. The first time I did a character that was like Austin Powers, I did it on stage. And it was a parody of all those British shows where really, really enthusiastic scientists would tell you how everything's made. And so it was a show called This Is How It's Made. And so I would show, like, this is a clothes washer. And here we have the barrel that the clothes go in and a piston that goes up and down. Does that make you horny? Does it? That piston, does it make you randy? To you, is it Eros Manifest? And that's where that crazy riff came from. And it just really made the audience uncomfortable. and that just was that thing of the 60s and everything that was sexualized, eroticized. There was sexy jobs, being a stewardess, sexy countries, Sweden, you know? And just how one day that just didn't happen anymore. And that's really the genesis of Austin Powers, is whatever happened to swingers. I literally was driving home from hockey practice and I heard The Look of Love by Burt Bacharach and went, what happened to swingers?
My guest is Mike Myers. His new film, The Love Guru, opens Friday. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mike Myers. His new film, The Love Guru, opens this weekend. When we left off, we were talking about his Austin Powers films. Let me play a clip of Dr. Evil, also from the first Austin Powers film. And in this scene, he's in a group therapy session for fathers and sons that are having problems together. And Dr. Evil's son is played by Seth Green. The group leader of the therapy session is Carrie Fisher. And Dr. Evil's son has a really serious complaint about his father.
I just think like he hates me. I really think he wants to kill me.
Now, Scott, we don't want to kill each other in here. We might say that we do sometimes, but we really don't.
Actually, the boy's quite astute. I really am trying to kill him, but so far unsuccessfully. He's quite wily, like his old man.
This is what I'm talking about.
Okay, well, we've heard from you, Scott. Now, you tell us a little about yourself.
The details of my life are quite inconsequential.
Oh, no, please, please. Let's hear about your childhood.
Yeah, okay. Come on, come on, please. Very well. Where do I begin? My father was a relentlessly self-improving boulangerie owner from Belgium with low-grade narcolepsy and a penchant for buggery. My mother was a 15-year-old French prostitute named Chloe with webbed feet. My father would womanize, he would drink. He would make outrageous claims like he invented the question mark. Sometimes he would accuse chestnuts of being lazy, the sort of general malaise that only the genius possess and the insane lament. My childhood was typical. Summers in Rangoon, luge lessons. In the spring, we'd make meat helmets. When I was insolent, I was placed in a burlap bag and beaten with reeds. Pretty standard, really. At the age of 12, I received my first scribe. At the age of 14, a Zoroastrian named Vilma ritualistically shaved my testicles. There really is nothing like a shorn scrotum. It's breathtaking. I suggest you try it.
You know, we have to stop.
Such a funny scene. And that's Mike Myers as Dr. Evil. And of course, Mike Myers is starring in the new movie, The Love Guru. Listening to Dr. Evil, to you do Dr. Evil, I'm thinking he sounds like if James Mason was a Nazi. Tell me about getting the voice for him.
It's Donald Pleasance more than anything. All bad guys in James Bond movies have a strange mid-Atlantic accent. And they often want to give away exactly how they're going to take over the world. They give up the plan easily.
That's true, isn't it?
Yeah. Here's how I'm going to do it so that you can have a countermeasure that will thwart it.
Exactly.
And so that accent emerged.
A lot of people say that the character of Dr. Evil is based in part on Lorne Michaels, and that Lorne Michaels had the habit that Dr. Evil has of putting his pinky in his mouth. Is that true?
Well, he doesn't have that habit anymore.
That would definitely break you.
No. The thing is, Lorne Michaels and I both have Canadian accents. And so my exotic guy is just going to end up sounding like somebody from Canada. I hardly saw Lorne Michaels, the man who gave me a break on television and the man who gave me a break in films. The man who I reference almost every day because he's one of those really brilliant thinkers. Really, the accent is Donald Pleasance. The pinky may have a faint resemblance to Mr. Michaels, but I have nothing but the utmost respect for Lorne Michaels. He's a great Canadian. I did a project on him in grade 8, and he's been a tremendous ally to me just an amazing mentor. He's a guy who has the patience to teach, and what he has to teach is very smart.
In Mel Brooks's movies, a lot of his movies are based on the premise, like, if Mel Brooks was back in history, what would history be like? You know, if Mel Brooks was a romantic lead, what would that be like? Did you feel that way about Austin Powers? If Mike Myers was this kind of like international spy, a man of mystery, what would he be like?
Well, I would be operating from a tremendous amount of low self-esteem and unprocessed wounding. You know, it's funny. When I started going out with girls, it was just right at the end of the sexual revolution. So I watched my older brothers, and I was like, wow, this is great. I can't wait. And then it was like, wah, 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 but not for you. You know, that looks great when you're 11. It's like, wow, I can't wait. You know, that'll be awesome. They were like on the game show, and it's a brand new car. I get on the game show, and it's a donkey. Wah, wah, wah. So it is a little bit of a fantasy realized. But, you know, the main thing that's interesting, you know, the Austin Powers, the reason, in my opinion, and this is the dramatic thesis, if you will, of a very, very broad and silly comedy, and everything I do is broad and silly. I try and give it an underpinning of something that is on my mind. But ultimately, the delivery system is very broad and silly. But my belief is that the sexual revolution didn't end because of a sexual counter-revolution. I don't think the right had anything to do with it, the moral right or whatever you want to call them. I think what happens is that that kind of swinging is an unsustainable lifestyle. I think when people cheat, it hurts their feelings. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think that...
Yes.
I, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I think that kind of stuff hurts. There's a hangover. There's an aftertaste. There's a price to be paid.
So were you scarred?
So
by...
true love triumphs over lust is the message of Austin Powers.
So were you scarred by missing the sexual revolution?
I felt a little ripped off. Yes, it didn't seem at all fair.
Mike Myers will be back in the second half of the show. His new movie, The Love Guru, opens Friday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Now's the time on Sprockets when we dance.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Nothing to Lose by Lee Child, his latest novel of suspense featuring former military cop Jack Reacher. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Mike Myers gets a little verklempt. Also, why are more children developing life-threatening food allergies? We'll ask Dr. Hugh Sampson, president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mike Myers. His new movie, The Love Guru, opens this week. Myers produced, wrote, and starred in three Austin Powers films, was the voice of Shrek, and was a cast member of Saturday Night Live from 1989 to 95. Now, there was a period when I was sure you were Jewish, even though it turns out you were raised Protestant. But I think I thought you were Jewish because you did the Linda Richman character so well on Saturday Night Live. And she was the Jewish woman from New York with the big 80s eyeglasses and the bouffant hair that you keep fluffing with her hands. And her conversation mm-hmm. always had Yiddish words in it, like verklempt yeah. and spilkes. And mm-hmm. So where did that come from?
Well, when I grew up in Toronto, you would hear in culture, like even the Indians in F Troop were like, I'm an Indian, you know. This is Meshuggah, you know. yeah. You know, as a comedy fan, you know, everybody, you know, Phil Silvers. See, this is my father was like, people weren't American, they weren't Canadian, they weren't English, they were from Showbiznia. But, you know, Bing Crosby was from Showbiznia.
Right.
And you just hear an accent that is New York, and I'm guessing now New York Jewish, could be New York Italian, it's hard to know, and when I came to New York, I couldn't believe that that accent existed in nature and that it wasn't just a literary convention. And it all came down to hearing somebody say, would you like a coffee? A coffee. And I thought, K-A-U-P-H-Y, coffee. You mean coffee? And it was daughter's dog's coffee, you know, no big whoop. And it's mellifluous, and it's because of comedy culture, it's familiar and it's comforting. The language of Yiddish is, I guess it's onomatopoetic, you know, to say something is drek. Actually, the word Shrek is Yiddish for scare. Ugh, I got such a Shrek. And now that I live in New York and have since 1989, it's the language of my people, I feel. I get very happy when I travel abroad and I hear, you know, dog's daughter, coffee. And, you know, since I'm 12, pocketbook, online, all of these things that remind me of what is now my home, which is New York City, you know.
What did you love about expressions like verklempt? Like, I can't talk now, I'm getting verklempt.
I'm getting a little verklempt. It sounds like it is. You know, you go into somebody's house and it's schmeck, which means clean. They keep a very schmeck house. Although there's not enough windows, it's a little finster, which is dark. Nishta heina, nishta here. That's another one I love.
For neither here nor there.
You know. Yeah, it's nishta heina, nishta here. And geg is into hate. Shaket bavakasha. These are the things. It feels closer to the sentiment. It's
Does verklempt means I'm getting choked up?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then some stuff I made up, like Spilkes is real, but Genekte Gezoink is not. You know, he has Spilkes in his Genekte Gezoink. I'm getting a little verklempt when I talk about him. He's in Boca Raton. He's recovering nicely, but he has Spilkes in his Genekte Gezoink.
Now, you were a child performer. I mean, you were in commercials starting when you were 9 or 10. Did you get the kind of training that, like a lot of kids in the 60s and maybe in the 70s too, were trained as if they were old vaudevillians? You know, like they would need to tap dance and sing and and do comedy and acting. Were you trained to do all of that?
I wasn't. You know, Conan O'Brien, when I first got on the show, because he was a writer on Saturday Night Live, he looked at me and he said, "You're from olden days. You're from yesteryear." And I went, I guess I am. I don't know. I just recently, PBS had a pledge, and they had the singing and dancing documentary. And I was watching, you know, An American in Paris and Gigi. And I was like, God, I want to make a movie like that. And then I thought, of course, not at that level of skill. But in my own way, I did sort of make movies like that. There is dancing in Austin Powers and in
There's
Love
a little
Guru.
Singing in the Rain tribute.
I'm just saying, it's like, you know, I think I'm old school that way. I think the training I did as an actor as a child ultimately is irrelevant to what I did in my adult years. I think it's night and day. I think, you know, when you're a little kid, it's the isn't it great that he can do that for a little kid? And then once you hit 18, there's no for a little kid, you know, disclaimer attached to it. I loved doing it as a kid. It was very, very interesting. My real training began at Saturday Night Live.
What's the worst thing that happened to you live on Saturday Night Live? The thing that really caught you up short?
On Sprockets, it was Dieter's dance party, and Lauren said, if you can take 2 minutes out of the sketch gets in. And he said this with, the show's at 11:30, he said this at 11:10. So I ran, broadcast news style, to the PAs, and I made cuts, and it went from Dieter's dance party top 10 to Dieter's dance party top 5. And they still hadn't changed the cue cards. And so some dude was behind the cue card guy, sweat, buckets of sweat, changing the cue cards. Because you can never really memorize your lines at Saturday Night Live because they change all the time because of standards and practices and Lauren's notes between dress and air. And I had to stall at one point. I go, number 3, you know, who are you to accuse me? Or whatever the name of the song was. Number 4. And the dude was furiously writing on the card, Schreibmaschine by the Love People, or whatever the name it was. The other thing was, when I did Wayne's World, it was a cold opening. It was the day that the Gulf War broke out. It was being changed 33 seconds up into air because we wanted to make sure that if the invasion, the first Gulf War, was going to be horrendous casualties, that we would be sensitive to the people in the armed forces. So anything that we thought might suggest, I don't know, being anything other than appreciative of the men in the armed services, we cut with 33 seconds to go to a live show. So that those are the two moments that were very significant to me. I've also cracked my head a million times backstage.
Really?
My body is mostly, oh, sure. Because I go night blind. You know, it's very, very bright lights. And then you go backstage to make a quick change. And I can't see anything. Literally, they have to, you know, pull me by the hand. I've, like, cut open my hand. My head is mostly scar tissue now.
Have you been bleeding live on the air?
Yes, I have. And then you just have to put the bleeding hand downstage behind your back.
Seriously? Yeah?
Oh, many times. I get very nervous, or not, it's adrenaline. And sometimes you cut yourself, you don't even know it.
Right.
And I've, like, knocked out teeth. I've got a scar over my right eye. My hand is all cut up. Many, 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 many quick change accidents.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Not at all. My pleasure.
Mike Myers' new movie, The Love Guru, opens Friday. Coming up, why are more people, particularly children, developing life-threatening food allergies? We'll talk with Dr. Hugh Sampson, president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. This is Fresh Air. If it seems to you that more people are developing life-threatening food allergies, you're right. There's no definitive explanation, but there's a few theories about why. My guest, Dr. Hugh Sampson, is the president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. He's a professor of pediatrics at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, where he directs the Jaffe Food Allergy Institute. Dr. Sampson, welcome to Fresh Air. What are some of the foods most likely to cause an allergic reaction?
Depending on the age of the individual, in very young children, the most common foods causing allergic reactions are milk, egg, and peanut. Less so things such as soy, wheat, fish, and shellfish. In older individuals and adults, the most common foods are peanuts, tree nuts, fish, and various shellfish.
So what causes an allergic reaction in the first place? Why do our bodies sometimes respond to food as if they're some kind of toxic?
Well, this is part of the immune system protective response. At a time when we had a great deal of difficulty with things such as parasites and worms, this form of the immune system was very effective in trying to rid us of those various pathogens. Now we don't confront those as often, and there seems to be some missignaling on the part of the immune system, whereby part of the immune system will inadvertently or incorrectly react against specific foods.
If our immune system is built the way it was to deal with parasites, why is it having a different response when it reacts to a food that it considers an enemy?
Part of it may be related to the way we program our immune system. And one of the theories out there as to why we're seeing more in the way of allergy is the so-called hygiene hypothesis. We know that the immune system gets programmed by bacteria that enters our gastrointestinal tract and on our skin shortly after birth. And also, there are effects of various infections that we have. And the theory is that we're not getting the appropriate signals, and that's leading to this misprogramming in certain individuals that lead to the allergic reactions.
Okay, so there's different theories about why so many people have allergic reactions to food now. You just started describing one of them, which is that we're not exposed to the same amount of pathogens as we used to be?
Correct.
And that's because of what, antibiotics and high-strength cleansers and things like that?
Better sanitation, more frequent use of antibiotics, better preservation of food products. A number of things that we've done that have very positive health benefits but may have, led to this inadvertent consequence.
So our immune system, which would have learned how to react to these genuine pathogens, isn't exposed to those pathogens that much, and so it freaks out with certain foods?
Yes, that's generally the theory.
Did I put that scientifically enough for you?
That's perfect.
So does that explain why the number of food allergies seems to be increasing?
Well, I'm not sure it does in total, and there are probably a number of different theories. So, for example, if we look at the prevalence of peanut allergy in our country, Canada, United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, it's the highest in the world. You go to areas of China where the consumption of peanut is really the same per capita, and you see virtually no peanut allergy. Similarly, in other countries in Africa, for example, peanut products are introduced very early. They're ingested quite frequently, and they see very little in the way of peanut allergy. Some of that may have to do with the way we prepare the foods that we eat. So with the case of peanut, in the U.S. and the other countries I mentioned, we generally consume them as in a dry roasted form. And this high heat of dry roasting actually brings about some changes, something called a Maillard reaction, in the peanut protein that actually makes it more allergenic or more likely to cause allergic reactions. Whereas in other countries in Africa and China, for example, they will much more frequently boil it, so you don't get that same change. We actually have developed a mouse model of peanut anaphylaxis whereby we can sensitize a mouse to experience a similar kind of reaction if they were to ingest peanut. But if we try to do it with the boiled peanut as opposed to the dry roasted, we really can't get much of a response. So that may have something to do with the way we prepare the foods. It may also have something to do with when we introduce foods. So, for example, there has been a study looking at the prevalence of peanut allergy in Israel. And in that study, it was noted that the prevalence was about one-tenth of what you saw in children in Hebrew school in London. And one of the things that is very different there is that in Israel, they use a weaning food or a food that they first give to a baby called bamba. And this bamba contains peanut, and it may be that actually rather than trying to restrict exposure to things such as peanut, which has been more of a common practice in our country, that perhaps giving large amounts early on may induce something called high-dose tolerance or may actually help prevent it. So this is another thing that is being looked into, and there actually is a very large study going on in London right now addressing this particular issue.
I know you've done some studying of Chinese medicine and Chinese herbs. What have you learned from Chinese medicine about food sensitivities and food allergies?
A lot of this work has been done by Dr. Xiumin Li, who is in our group and who actually came to Mount Sinai with me from Hopkins when I came about 10 years ago. Interestingly, there is nothing about food allergy in the books of traditional Chinese medicine. So she, through a lot of reading and such, came up with some formulations that she thought potentially would be effective. So she combined things related that were related to allergy and also related to some kinds of responses in the gastrointestinal tract, and used these formulations in our mouse model of peanut anaphylaxis, and was able to show that it completely blocked the allergic response that we were seeing. We subsequently done some work trying to understand what they actually do, and they have direct effects on the immune system, turning down some of the signals that promote this allergic reactivity. So we don't fully understand what they're doing, but they're very impressive in these animal models. And now we do have approval from the FDA and have a study that has been started in humans looking at the possibility that this may be an effective way to treat food allergy.
I think it's kind of exciting that the medical field is looking into Chinese herbs as a way of treating food allergies.
We have to certainly keep an open mind, and I'm always open for anything that might be useful in treating food allergy. I've been dealing with it for about 25 years, and you know, up till this point, about the only thing we could tell our patients was you had to avoid foods and try to teach them what dangerous situations were, and people continue to make mistakes. Food allergy is still a leading cause of anaphylaxis.
Which is what?
Anaphylaxis is a severe allergic reaction in which many of the, again, what I'll call target organs, so your respiratory tract, like your nasal passages, your throat, your lungs, your gastrointestinal tract, your skin, and even your cardiovascular system, your heart and your blood pressure can all be affected at one time. And this is something that can happen very rapidly and lead to death. And in this country, as I say, it is the single leading cause of these kinds of reactions that are treated in emergency departments in the U.S. Various estimates would put that in the range of 125,000 visits to emergency rooms in the U.S. This is based on a recent study published by one of the FDA groups, and then also leading to over 3,000 hospitalizations, and possibly from other studies, 100 to 150 deaths per year. So, fairly serious problem.
My guest is Dr. Hugh Sampson, president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Hugh Sampson. He's the president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and he's the director of the Jaffe Food Allergy Institute at Mount Sinai Medical Center. He's also a professor of pediatrics there. How reliable are food labels in packaged products now in terms of telling you if there is, soy or nuts or gluten or egg, you know, whatever the offending product is. Because sometimes there's just like traces of it. It's not like it's an egg product per se.
Right. With the new food labeling law that went into effect about 2 years ago now, the labeling has become much better and is much clearer. So, for example, a number of years ago, they could have on the label sodium caseinate, and this is on something that's called a non-dairy creamer, and you would think, well, there's no milk, but casein or caseinate is milk protein, and it's actually the major milk protein. Today, if you put something like that in there, it has to have milk. So the eight foods that are most often responsible for food allergic reactions, so milk, egg, wheat, soy, peanut, various tree nuts, fish, shellfish, all have to be specified on the ingredient label that they are contained in this particular food. I think one of the problems we're getting into is there's never really been sufficient studies to know, can there be any trace at all of a particular food within a product and have it still be safe? Because we know from doing these various food challenges that often people will tolerate very low amounts of food. And what's happened is if the company is not completely sure that there's we'll talk about peanut, that there's no peanut at all in there, they will put may contain traces of peanut or, you know, made in a plant that contains or that handles peanut. And what's happened is many foods that people had been eating without any difficulty all of a sudden have this warning label on it, and now their diets are even more restricted. So this is something that really needs to be looked at carefully in order to help us give people the best possible diet.
Are there issues that pregnant women or mothers who are breastfeeding should keep in mind that might increase or decrease their child's tolerance to food?
Yeah, this is you've really hit on one of the new hot areas that's become very controversial. In the past, we thought we knew what to do, which was we were recommending that people delay the introduction of some of these major allergens. But then stepping back and looking at what's happened with the prevalence of food allergy, which is that it's increasing, and looking at the evidence that we have to support the idea that people should restrict their foods, the evidence doesn't support that as a valid way to go. And the American Academy of Pediatrics just came out in January with new guidelines basically saying that we don't have sufficient evidence to tell either pregnant mothers or mothers who are breastfeeding that there's a great advantage to trying to restrict any of these major allergens. If we look at what studies are out there, there are studies that really suggest either approach, either there's a little bit of data, but it's not in any way conclusive, and there's conflicting data to suggest that if you restrict it, you may prevent some of these allergies. But there's also some evidence out there, and experience in Israel with the early introduction of Bomba is one such case where it's suggesting that maybe we should be introducing these foods earlier in larger amounts. So right now, we really don't have good evidence-based data to tell us what is the best way mothers should go. And so I can tell you in my clinic, basically, I explain to the mothers that we don't have good data and that they can really do what they're most comfortable with and should in no way ever feel guilty about the outcome, because we can't tell them at the moment what is the best way to do it.
Let me ask you, there's a lot of reactions some people get to food that I'm not sure you'd describe as allergic or not, or as an official sensitivity, but it doesn't agree with them. For instance, mm-hmm. certain foods in some people can cause bloating or cramping or, you know, bowel problems. Some people think they get itchy after certain foods, but it's not a full-blown, mm-hmm. Not full-blown hives, or certainly not an anaphylaxis right. reaction where, you know, several organs swell and are, possibly endangering your life. What do you think of those more minor reactions? Do you think of them as food allergies or intolerances or something different altogether?
Right. No, I think many of these are what we call food intolerances. We don't have or we don't believe they're due to a reaction in the immune system, but clearly there are people who can't ingest certain kinds of vegetables or fruits without getting cramping. Now, we know there are some individuals, especially young children, have something called delayed maturation of the fructase enzyme. So this is like lactose that's used to break down sugars in milk. Fructose is one to break down sugars in fruits and certain vegetables. And there are some young children that don't turn that on right away and consequently end up getting fairly severe cramping and diarrhea. And it's likely that there are other kinds of variations in some of this enzyme activity that happens in adults that lead to cramping and, you know, significant discomfort. And I think a lot of adults just figure out they can't eat a certain food and just don't eat it.
Is that something you're studying or is that like too low level for your research?
Well, it's not too low level because I have a few of my own. But no, right now I'm focusing on the allergic response. I'd love to be able to you know, get by that one, have some forms of therapy, and then I'd be very interested to look at many of these others because it is clearly something that does distress a fairly significant portion of the population.
Dr. Sampson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Dr. Hugh Sampson is the president of the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. He directs the Jaffe Food Allergy Institute at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Patty Leswing, Jonathan Menhivar, and John Sheehan. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. And from the American Psychological Association and its 150,000 members, bringing the science and practice of psychology to daily living at apa.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the legal aftermath of Gitmo and why, under international law, some members of the Bush administration may face investigation in other countries. We talk with Philippe Sands, the author of Torture Team and director of the Center of International Courts and Tribunals at University College London. Join us for the next Fresh Air.